You are listening to the Fandom Podcast. Let your geek flag fly. New episodes Mondays on fandompodcast.com.
This episode is brought to you by Chris Hardwick's Fun Comfortable Tour, coming to Kingsbury Hall in Salt Lake City on November 6th. Get more information at fandompodcast.com/funcomfortable. Welcome to the Fandom Podcast, the show that is not about comics, not about movies, and not even about Doctor Who, Supernatural, or Firefly. We are a show about all of that and much more. I am Brandon Uscio, and joining me from District 1 is our career, Jordan Caldwell.
Hey everyone, just want to remind y'all who's number one as we go through this episode.
And from District 4, Nathan Caldwell.
I have fresh salmon for everybody.
Okay, so for those of you who are like, what in the world is going on? This week is our book club episode for The Hunger Games, book one. So we're going to be talking about that a little bit. But before we talk about that, we're going to cover some of the top news from this week. Jordan, why don't you lead us off?
Jack Black having a good weekend because of Goosebumps, but also a little splash with the Walking Dead fans. He's a fan of the show, but he made some headlines because of a quote. He says, "I love that show," referring to The Walking Dead. "But it's really a soap opera that me and my lady have become addicted to. It's become such a soap opera, and it's just a money grab. There's no arc. It's sort of heading to this conclusion." So I'm a fan of Jack Black. Kind of got a little laugh out of this because Walking Dead is just a soap opera. I don't know about his arc comment. Although it's slow, admittedly, I haven't watched season 5, so I can't know what's going on with the story. But I think it does make sense when comparing it to the soap opera in that, yes, there's a story, but it's so dragged out and it takes so long to resolve and it seems like nothing is happening, as opposed to a more traditional story arc. But I know that's ruffled a lot of feathers, and so I'll kick it over to Nate as big Walking Dead fan. How do you, react to comments?
Yeah, I see it, and I've got to, like, disagree with him. Just, I mean, when you say that, you know, it's become a soap opera, like, if you're just talking about, like, the drama, then I guess, but, like, if he's talking about it's become a soap opera, as in that there is no, that you watch a soap opera and all that changes is who's sleeping with who sort of thing, then I really disagree with him, especially, you know, they haven't followed the comic, but they've stayed kind of in line with a lot of the story arcs that have been in the comics. And so when you say there's no arc, it turns to really what Kirkman has done in the comics and what they're doing with the TV show. And with the whole, like, where they're at in Alexandria is one of the story arcs, like, I finished this summer. And so to say there's no, to me, I immediately say, yes, there is, because I know what story arc they're doing from the comics. And there may be changes and stuff from it, but there are story arcs that they're doing. It's not just a soap opera where you're in one little city and you got some main characters and then they just never go anywhere. Gone a lot of places with this and done a lot of story arcs, but we'll probably just not get into that. We could probably spend our whole time fighting over The Walking Dead.
Probably.
So I'm just going to move forward to our second news story, which with the Star Wars Episode 7 coming out, there was an article releasing what theaters are going to do Star Wars marathons. And here in Utah, the district is the only theater that will be hosting this marathon, and we'll have a link to that article in the show notes. You can look and see if you can find one in your state. Along with that also came a new Star Wars poster, which, you know, of course, over the next week is going to be nitpicked and everything, and I'm going to start that overanalyzing right here, because I seem to notice when I look at it, you don't see Mark Hamill on there, and we all know we've got this mysterious Jedi, you know, with the red lightsaber. And since the first little teaser they've put out, I've had this feeling that that's what path Luke is going to go down, since you don't see Mark Hamill's face anywhere on the poster. I think, you know, it just gives credence to my little conspiracy theory. If you're jonesing for some Star Wars Episode 7, and whether you're a sports fan or not, then listening to this on Monday morning, you need to be watching the Eagles versus Giants on ESPN Monday Night Football, and during the halftime break, they're going to release a new trailer, and I saw somebody post on Facebook when this, the headlines Tuesday will read that Monday Night Football sets record for audience viewing whatever Star Wars movie trailer shows. So, a lot of Star Wars Episode 7 news coming at you, and this is all in that article we'll have a link to. But before we get to Episode 7, we've got another beloved sci-fi franchise that's coming up shortly, Brandon.
So, on Wednesday, October 21st, it marks the date that Marty McFly jumps forward into time to in Back to the Future. So if anyone ever was wondering where their hoverboard is, it better be here by Wednesday, I'm just saying. I know like Nike is re-releasing those self-sealing shoes. They did a run of those before, but I saw a news story that they're going to do some more and actually make them affordable this time, because they only released like 500 of them, and it got ridiculously expensive. So, and if you're concerned that we're not going to give you your Back to the Future fix, make sure to listen in next week. We're going to cover Back to the Future. You know, it talks about how the Cubs are going to win the World Series. So I'm just saying, it's one of those things where it actually is kind of scary, how accurate some of the things are, but kind of comical in some of the things that they missed. So, Back to the Future Day, Wednesday, October 21st. Pull up your... I know AMC is doing a marathon, and I believe that the Fathom Events is doing a showing on Wednesday for Back to the Future Day. We'll have some more information in the show notes. So, we wanted to cut back news a little bit and only go over these three stories because we have... we've gotten some feedback, and I've been put in my place. Nick English wrote in. He said, did you really just call Nightmare Before Christmas a claymation? Come on, stop motion animation. This is not the California Raisins from the 1980s. Don't insult me like this, LOL. Okay, so I have to admit that I misspoke. Claymation was more for like Gumby and California Raisins, things without detail. It is a subset of stop motion, but I'm just going to say, and the blame is all on me because I said it, and Jordan after me very clearly said stop motion, so my bad. So guys, if you ever hear us say something and you're like, no, that's not right, you've got to fix that, leave us a comment. We'll read it on the air. I have no shame. I will have a retraction. All right, Nick, I hope that made you feel a little bit better. And then some other contact that we had was Amanda. She wrote in, and she is actually in a college class. She was telling us about this creative college class that she is in, and she had a question for us and asked us, what does fandom mean to us? And hopefully we'll be able to spend some time and sit down and talk really in depth about that. But I actually wanted to throw it out to the audience, and I want to know what you guys think fandom means to you. I'll post it on social media, or you can leave a comment on the episode post, but let us know, what does fandom mean to you? Amanda's trying to put together an episode of a podcast for a college class. I think that sounds like a pretty cool college class to me. So if you guys have anything that you can add to it, tell us what your fandoms are, what it means to you. And then in a couple weeks, we will sit down and we will talk about what fandom means to us. All right. So if you guys want to have your name mentioned or ask a question or give us a correction, make sure to contact us either on the website or facebook.com/fandompodcast or on Twitter @fandomcast. We'll love to hear from you. I'd love to have you throw out some ideas. All right, guys, we are halfway through our fun, comfortable tour giveaway, and we've been talking about it for a few weeks now. So the Fun Comfortable Tour, if you've been under a rock or haven't been listening to our podcast, it is done by comedian Chris Hardwick, and he's a really funny guy. He is all about his fandoms. He is he's kind of a great ambassador for the geeks. He goes out there and he makes geek adjacent jokes, things that we can enjoy. He loves his fandoms. The Fun Comfortable Tour is coming to Kingsbury Hall in Salt Lake City on November 6th, and tickets are $35. We have all the information over on fandompodcast.com/funcomfortable. There's a big link that says buy tickets, and it takes you over to Kingsbury Hall's website to buy tickets. They are running out really fast. But, you know, if you aren't able to get them before they run out, we are doing a giveaway. And it's kind of jumped around, but we have a pair of tickets to the Fun Comfortable Tour on November 6th to give away. And all we need you to do is to answer Amanda's question. Tell us what fandom means to you, either on the episode post or on a comment on our website, any of our social media. And then go over to fandompodcast.com/funcomfortable. Fill out the form at the bottom. Even if you've done it once already, fill it out multiple times. That way we can know that you are very intent on winning these tickets. So fill that out. Let us know why you want to win it. Let us know that you shared something or that you answered this question. Again, fandompodcast.com/funcomfortable. If you are looking for a taste of Chris Hardwick's humor before you commit to buying some tickets, he hosts a TV show at midnight on Comedy Central, which is on at midnight. So, and it's just kind of a comedy game show, pulling in clips from the internet and other hilarity ensues.
Definitely always support Chris Hardwick and give a big second to go watch at midnight. It's a great way to kind of see the humor from a fan of basically an ultimate nerd like us that is kind of living his dream job. And he's basically just himself, and there's other great comedians on there. But yeah, if you've never heard him in a comedic setting, maybe you've only seen him on Talking Dead, then definitely a good show to watch to get to see his Fun Comfortable Tour.
All right. Well, with that, why don't we jump over to our book club? Jordan, why don't you introduce us?
We are doing Hunger Games. I believe this is the third installment of our book club. Figure it's one that most fans read or at least heard of with the movies coming out. The final installment of the movies are coming out soon. So we're going to focus on the first book, go into that. And I believe Brandon has a synopsis for us for those that haven't read it.
All right. So The Hunger Games is broken down into three different parts. And it is about the adventures of Katniss Everdeen, who is forced to engage in a fight-to-the-death tournament against other children. So the novel takes place in Panem, a dystopic country built on what was once North America. In a world of limited resources, the despotic government run by the capital keeps its citizens in line by separating them into districts and reinforcing severe class separations. But their strongest tool to promote the disunion and discourage rebellion is the Hunger Games, a yearly event where two tributes from each district are pitted against each other for the country to watch on television. So Katniss lives with her mother and her younger sister Prim in District 12, the poorest of the districts, and ever since her father's death, she has been the family's provider, hunting illegally in the woods outside the district with her friend Gale. The novel begins on the day of the reaping, when each district must select two tributes, one male and one female, to represent them in the Hunger Games. When Prim is selected as the female tribute, Katniss offers herself as a volunteer and is allowed to serve as a tribute alongside Peeta, a middle-class boy from the district. So the remainder of part one of the novel follows the children as they are both trained for the brutal games and groomed to portray a certain image for the audience, and she forces herself into a stoic determination to win, a philosophy made difficult by the kindly Peeta. The relationship is even made more fraught when Peeta confesses during a live interview that he has a crush on Katniss. Though she fears making emotional connections that could compromise her desire to win, she agrees to portray the image of a unified front, an idea proposed by their sponsor, Haymitch. So the games are then held in a forested area, and they begin, and Katniss rushes away from the initial bloodbath, and she gets separated from Peeta, and she learns that Peeta allied himself with the career tributes, those tributes from the richer districts who train their entire lives for the games. And meanwhile, in the background, the game makers are the ones who design the games and keep manipulating their surroundings to keep the game quote-unquote entertaining. And so they force the groups together and they force conflict. And Katniss meets up with another tribute named Rue, who's the youngest tribute, who Katniss associates with Prim, her sister, and Katniss and Rue form an alliance and make a plan to destroy the supplies that are keeping the Kreers powerful. Rue sets fires to distract them, and so they go out, and I'll leave it right here. There's spoilers if you haven't read the book and you're concerned about it. It's been quite a while, but Rue is killed by another tribute who then quickly becomes Katniss's first kill, and as a small act of rebellion against the capital, which expects the tributes to dehumanize one another, Katniss sings to Rue and decorates her corpse with flowers before the body is fetched by the capital. In order to bring back the romantic aspect of the story, the game makers announce that the rules have changed and that two tributes from a district can serve as co-victors. She then finds Peeta, who was badly cut after helping Katniss escape from the Kreers, and she does her best to help him recover, but it isn't until Haymitch sends her a gift following a kiss she shares with him that she understands that playing up the romance angle could pay off. So they spend some time working together and healing Peeta, but then the game makers eventually push them together again, and their main challenge turns out not to be the sole remaining Kreer, but several wolfman-type mutation creatures that were unleashed by the game makers, creatures that seemingly are reanimated from the corpses of the dead tributes. Katniss and Peeta escape by climbing to high ground while the other tribute falls and is tortured by the creatures. Finally, Katniss kills the tribute with her arrow and puts him out of his misery. They have won the games, but the game makers rescind the rule about duel victors. Peeta and Katniss threaten to commit duel suicide, which would ruin the games, and they are hence awarded a duel victory. They are fetched by the capital representatives and separated for a long period of recovery. When they are brought out to the audience again, Haymitch warns Katniss that she needs to overplay the lover's angle as a defense for her threat to commit suicide, which the capital considers an act of rebellion. Over the period of fanfare that follows, she takes his advice, which makes Peeta, who actually does love her, very happily. When all is done, they head back to District 12, and Katniss lets slip along the way that her affection was always for the cameras. Though not the entire truth, she is torn between her old identity as a poor hunter and the more complex one she shaped through the games. Peeta is heartbroken, but understands they must maintain an image as they prepare to present themselves to their district. And that is where the first book in the trilogy ends. So quite a bit goes on, but it's also a fairly good, quick read. So, Jordan, why don't you lead us on this conversation?
Yeah, good summary there, Flip. I imagine most of our audience has at least seen the first movie. So keep in mind there are some differences, but pretty close. But to start, we're just going to talk about, did you read it before the movie? Did you read it after the movie? How'd you like it? Nate, we'll kick it to you first on that.
I read all three books, like one right after another. I downloaded on Kindle and downloaded, but I read it on getting home from Iraq in 2012. And so this is just before the came out. I'd read all three. And I mean, there's parts of it that really connected with me. Parts like Katniss's sacrifice she makes, like, really resonated with me because as an older brother, like, I would like, if in that situation, that I would do the same thing Katniss did. Not long after reading them, I heard an interview with Collins talking about she came up with the idea while flipping back and forth between reality TV and news coverage of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And this kind of makes sense where she could see, you know, she's going from reality TV to some of the more horrific images that get shown on the news of things going on in the war. As a society, we'd like to think, you know, hey, that's a far leap of us getting to, you know, maybe not necessarily kid. There may be a point where society starts putting, you know, reality TV on, where instead of just being on an island trying to survive and voting people off, that it gets more drastic. And Suzanne Collins does a very good job painting the picture of this world that Katniss lives in and any of the games. It just a very well written, especially first book and trilogy, very good. But since we're just talking the first book, we'll stay to that. And I would have to say, out of the trilogy, the first book is my favorite. I thought it was very well done. Jordan is the English major. I'm sure you're approach to it was different than mine as the soldier. Thoughts on it?
General initial thoughts. It is a book that I like. Admittedly, I never did to read the book even after seeing the movies. I'm not one that's usually big on kind of young adult novels, but it just happened to be for one of my classes this semester. So I figured I have to read it eventually, might as well read it now and do it in time for our book club. But upon reading it, it is a lot deeper than most young adult novels. It does fit very well into that kind of dystopian society genre of like about Fahrenheit 451, 1984, those kind of novels. And it within that, it is very interesting. It isn't just one book. It sets up for the rebellion in later books. So many dystopian novels, you see this society and how, and it kind of just one thing kind of works out for another, more or less the apes that society, or ends up, you know, being punished, and it shows the evils of that society. I guess the most common example would be The Giver. And although that's also a series, at the end of The Giver, really the society isn't changed. The protagonist just escapes that society. For those that have read Fahrenheit 451, the society hasn't really changed. The protagonist just escapes that society and finds a new hidden society in which they carry on literature through spoken word. And so for this, it's very interesting within that genre that it actually sets up for the overthrow society. So for an English perspective, that's something that I really find interesting and will most likely lead me to reading the rest of the. But yeah, other than that, my main, you know, experience with it has been the movie. So I'm really excited for this podcast, finally reading the first book and getting to discuss it a bit. So Brandon, when did you first read the Hunger Games?
So I first read the Hunger Games quite a while back. It was well before the movie was released. I believe it was before the third book was released when I started reading it too. I was working at an elementary school and I actually checked it out of their library, and that was one of the hangups that I had about this. So I like to, as I'm reading books, I'll read something heavier, and then after reading something heavier, I'll read a young adult book to kind of cleanse my palate. And so with the Hunger Games, I was like, well, this will just be this. It's published by Scholastic, you know, the same literary geniuses who published Goosebumps and Animorphs, you know, the real high class literature right there. So I thought, you know, this won't be too much of a thought provoker or anything like that. So I checked it out from the elementary school's library and read it, and just thinking it would be quick and simple. And it was pretty quick. It was simple, but it was definitely thought provoking. I was really kind of shocked at the way that Suzanne Collins portrayed just the indifference by so many different people, because like you said, it's a slippery slope that we're on right now that could lead to this. I'd like to think that it wouldn't, but this was one of the first, because right now there is a big rejuvenation of dystopian worlds in young adult literature. And this is one of the ones I feel like that kicked it off. And because of the success of this one, so many others are doing these dystopian futures where you can put these things out there and, you know, kids can think about their relationships and who are they actually, but they can also think about how society works without having to fall into the stereotypes of what they have. I think that it was a pretty interesting take on our social system. And even though we are not as rigidly divided into these classes, there is a lot of social mobility that we lack, that this book could be used to talk about our current society and the lack of mobility there. So I thought it was very thought provoking, even though I did not expect it to be thought provoking at all.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that. Not that I didn't think it would be thought provoking, because obviously I had seen the movie first, but it's definitely a much better piece of than I expected it to be. And after reading it, not surprised to find it in a college course. But moving on a little bit, I know I'm the English major and, you know, so running a book club, it may become a little literature heavy. But to start out, we're going to focus on more of the actual fan stuff, the big talking points of the book. And the biggest thing is obviously the Hunger Games itself. So as we see throughout the book, games start before you enter the arena. It starts with interviews. It starts with making a grand appearance. There's training in which, aside from the personal training, you have the opportunity to interact with the other competitors in the games. So we're going to start with what would our strategy be before we entered the arena? For me personally, I'm a very social person. I get along very well with different groups and cliques and demographics. And although the social structure is different in Hunger Games, there are a lot of parallels, like Brandon talked about. And with my personality, especially through high school, I was the kid who could be best friends with that annoying jock that everyone hated except for the other popular kids. And I could also be best friends with the nerdy anime kid that everyone made fun of except for the other. So I would definitely put that to use. Not speaking game, not speaking strategy, just speaking to the other competitors, making them get to know me on a personal and social level, so that regardless of how they see me as a competitor, I'm someone that they think that they can see themselves working with me, and I would be able to use that as a benefit. It's very important. By definition, everyone in the arena is your enemy, but it's important to have people that are willing to work with you rather than making you a target. So that would be my number one priority, is making sure that I'm no one's target and that everyone I'm competing against would also be willing to work with me. And being a career, working with someone from a lower district, or being someone from a lower district, gaining the trust of the careers. And outside of that, as it comes to the interviews and everything, as hard as it, I think it would be for a lot of people, honestly, I would put my full in my advisors. And you see this a lot with Katniss, and she questions this and that and doesn't like certain things that she's doing. And you may get unlucky and get a terrible but I'm also humble enough to know that obviously this would be my first situation, and they're the ones with the experience. They're the ones that know what is going on with people that may become sponsors and support me. So regardless of what I think, regardless of what I think the best course of action, I think you have to put all of your trust in these advisors and really listen to their advice. If you think your costume that they have you dressed up in makes you look weird and it's going to be way off, trust them, because it might work out. If you have a hard time in interviews, or your personality may not come across the best like Katniss's does, trust in your advisors. Learn the right things to say. Learn how to portray yourself. Of course, a lot easier said than done. But basically, it just comes down to really being a likable person. So, Brandon, what would your strategy be?
So my strategy would be similar and a little different than yours. So I have always been able to make friends with a diverse group of people, kind of like you were saying. However, I would not say that I'm good at it. I'm kind of an awkward guy. But in a situation like the Hunger Games, I would try to show people my value and why they might want / need me. Because, you know, I'm a big guy and I am fairly intelligent. So, you know, try to make people see, oh, we could use that guy. And if only to say we're going to use him, at least that gets you through the first thing. But then, very much like you, I would also say I would just completely try to learn everything that I could about the games, because I'm the kind of person who likes to know everything before I go in. And I know that in the way the Hunger Games are designed, that's not possible. But Haymitch has been to so many of these, and honestly, he's seen so many people not make it, that he has some experience. I would be all over getting information from him. I would probably handle myself in interviews pretty similarly to Katniss, where she is very awkward and doesn't always have the right answers. I probably would not be like Katniss in the fact that in these interviews, she always accidentally says the right thing. I probably would accidentally say the wrong thing, but I would be looking for advice from anybody who has experience that I could. You know, I I would try to make it in with the careers because they have the most advice on their side, the most, you know, make it through that first part and then maybe do what kind of what PETA did and bail on them. So, you know, my strategy is a little simpler. Just try to make friends with the powerful people and the people who know what's going on and then move on to working by yourself, by myself. Nate, what would your strategy be? This is where I have a feeling your military background is going to come out if it hasn't already.
Yeah, this is very different from your guys's, and not to say that I'm not a sociable person or that I can't be sociable, or because I feel like I can be very sociable and talk with people. But I also look at, you know, this is literally a life or death competition. And when I compete at things seriously, I'm very focused. And the last thing I want to do is be friends with that person over on the other team. And so if I'm going into this knowing that I've got people that in order to win this have to die, then I'm going to be focused on my training and I will be, you know, probably cordial, I think is the word I would choose for my competitors, but accepting and knowing the fact that I'm not going to be someone's favorite to win it, but there wouldn't be a lot of bets on me being the first one out, but I would sit and analyze those that are considered the top and find out where their weaknesses are and figure out how I can exploit them in training before we ever get into it. When it came to things like then, I would just more talk up myself and my confidence and being able to go out there and belief in myself. Where Jordan, you know, would put the trust in his advisor, my attitude would be more, you know, if that's not the advice that they gave me, then I probably wouldn't listen to him. I would probably be more like Katniss in that regard, of the sense of I'm not going to go out there and be something I'm not. And so my social strategy would be to be antisocial. And I would probably be one of the first ones dead anyways. But I don't know if it's the best strategy, but knowing myself, like, that's in that situation, that's how I would react to it. I mean, the last thing I can talk and be buddy-buddy with someone, knowing that in a couple days I may have to run a sword through them or something. So just wouldn't be able to be social and friendly nice.
Not going to say that surprises me, because it's very fitting. But depending how well you focus certain skills and how well you analyze your competitors, I can see it paying off in the arena. So once we move to a lot of it becomes a very different game. So for this, we're going to work under the premise that our pre-arena strategies were somewhat successful and kind of building off of that. So Brandon, what would your strategy be once you went up that tube and saw the cornucopia?
So I would probably run out there and try to get some stuff, and hopefully I don't die. If my pre-strategy worked out well, the careers wouldn't be gunning for me. So I could go out and get some supplies, and then kind of get out of the fray after I get what I want, what I need, and then after a while, I really would see it being more like how PETA survived, where he tagged along with him for a while, and then once he had what he needed, he basically left the group. Now I'm not going to say that I would leave the group for some girl that I had barely talked to, but just there would be a reason and a time for me to leave the group, because like Nate said, eventually when you're out there, you're all enemies, you're on the other team. So get what you need and then get out. It would be my strategy, and it would probably fail me. I'm not gonna lie. Somebody else may be able to make that strategy work, but probably not me. So that's my strategy.
Yeah, my strategy would, knowing that once I rise up out of the tube, that I've got 60 seconds that I have to stand on that platform. And it would just be those 60 seconds analyzing the area around me, because no two arenas have ever been the same, and seeing where I'm at, you know, taking in what I'm closest to inside the cornucopia, but then also, you know, who's to my left and right. If they're ones that I feel like I can outrun to get to something inside the cornucopia, or if ones that if I try for it, that because I've analyzed my competitors, that they can get to it before me, then look at going the other way and not getting involved in the middle of the cornucopia stuff. And if I decide that's going to be my option, then maybe I'm looking at where one of the weaker competitors is at and seeing if I can position myself to follow them and kind of, and hopefully they get something that then I can take them out and take what they've got. Kind of more going in planning that unless I get lucky in my position coming up, that I'm immediately going to fall back to safe territory, and I may go a day or two without food, but I'm going to find a place where I can hole up and I can position myself to ambush competitors and I can off of them, that, you know, I'm not foolish enough to get involved in the middle of the cornucopia unless I know for sure I can take out the person to the left and the right of me. Then after that, after those first couple days, if I've survived that long, instead of just staying back waiting to ambush, then I'm going to start going on the hunt. And once I've found out where they're at, see if they've got a routine, see if they, you know, see if I can find a way where I can attack them without necessarily going head on against them, unless it's one that I feel like that I can easily, but by this point I would figure most of them are out of it. But just trying to have to use growing up being a hunter and use that to my advantage of moving in the woods and moving behind cover and finding ways to come at someone sideways and just trying to do my best to survive to the last. So, Jord, you're not so much the fighter, but you definitely can have a temper at times. What's your strategy in the arena?
I definitely can have a temper, and I think part of that may lead to some of my ruthless mentality in the arena. But going with my social aspect, I realize that number one, then I become an easy target for a group of people. Number two, keep your friends close, but your enemies closer. If I am able to align myself with the people that I view as the biggest threats, then I know I'm not their target until we get down to, say, the last five, last six people. Not that I don't have confidence, but I also know that I have the belief that there's always someone worse than you, but there's always someone better than you. And so especially in the arena, that's a place that you can't be overconfident. So again, like you, as I come up, I'd be analyzing my surroundings, analyzing how the cornucopia is set up, analyzing who is near me. But most importantly, I would be analyzing the specific items, things that I could use or things that would make me valuable. Again, working off the premise that I've been social with people, if I get something of value and they can look at me as someone who fight and have to kill me for that, or they can work with me and we can work together to fight others, then I think that's really the only way to make the cornucopia work. And again, because I'm not someone that would go out on my own, I have to make the cornucopia work. After that, it really just becomes an issue of holding your own and surviving that initial bloodbath. But like I said, I would hope that I'm likable enough, I'm anyone's targets, that the people near me, the people that I see, are people that I could work with. And hopefully it would be the careers or the most skilled people. And I can align with that group to kind of go up similar to PETA did. But I think PETA kind of did it more out of either I align with these guys or get killed. I don't think he was ever positioned to use those people to an advantage. And this is where the ruthlessness comes in. So don't judge me too hard. Consider, you know, the circumstances of what we're talking about. But we'd be in a situation in which only one person can survive. So obviously, if you're everyone around you has to die. And I'm not making light of killing another person. And again, this is fictional. This is hypothetical. I think it would be very important to get to a position of trust. And it may take another person working with me, but to where essentially we find ourselves or myself in a place of advantage, whether it's night watch or something, that I can take out all four or five of those people at one time while they're sleeping, while they're at a significant disadvantage. Because although I lose my alliance and my support system, if I align with the right people, then now taken out the four biggest competitors in the games. And then I have their supplies. And ideally, I would have to find another person so that we could still find myself in isolation. But at the same time, once you show that you're not necessarily a trustworthy person, it becomes hard to trust another person or a person to trust you. So the combination of the initial bloodbath and then taking out the top four people, if successful, would put me into where I could get through the end of the games and find positions of advantage to take out those people that are isolated, like PETA finds himself, like you. And in all reality, if I couldn't get to that point, obviously there's a lot of risk involved, a lot of places where I might die before then. But if I couldn't get to becomes a lasting game, and in all honesty, I don't think I could last the way that Katniss lasted. I don't think off my heels alone I could go out regardless of the territory, and adding in the crazy stuff that the game makers throw in there, it would be very hard for me to go too far into the game without making a big splash and getting the main competitors out very early on. So easier said than done. But I think that's a good little talk on the strategy for the arena. Of course, for the listeners, what's wrong with our strategies? What would your strategy be? It's a crazy thing, but one that you can talk for on a long, long hypothetical that Suzanne Collins has created. So shifting from that, going back a little bit more to the literature aspect of the book, I've heard it said before that Suzanne Collins writes Katniss in a way that she doesn't have to make any hard decisions. A lot of things kind of seemingly work out for her. And this is one of the few criticisms I've heard of the book. Nate, what are your thoughts on this? Does Katniss have to make hard decisions, or does Suzanne Collins give us a real solid character here?
It depends on what you define as a hard decision. If they're criticizing Suzanne Collins because, you know, like you said, in the synopsis, Katniss's first kill comes as a reaction more than a thought. And, you know, one of her, you know, some of her other kills and stuff come that because of situation and circumstance more than Katniss necessarily hunting and stalking them, then your Katniss doesn't make those hard decisions. But Katniss made the decision to volunteer in place of her sister. Katniss makes the decision when they announce that PETA, you know, that two from the same district, this one, that she's giving up someplace she's safe and secure to go find PETA. You know, and that decision may be motivated because cousin and she wins, that she won't be, you know, she'll get back to District 12 and people will be angry with her for not trying to save PETA. But it was still a risk. It was still a hard decision, you know. It wasn't an easy thing for her to give up her safety and security in an area where she knows she has gain to try to go find PETA, not knowing where necessarily even to look for him. She had an idea where to start. But then after that, it had been a few days since she'd seen PETA, so she didn't know where he could be by that point. She makes the decision with Rue kind of helps her, but she makes the decision to keep Rue as an ally when the easy thing would have been to, she could have either just taken Rue out, which wasn't really Katniss's personality, or she could have, like, okay, we're even now, I'm letting you go. But instead, she chose to make Rue an ally, even though she knew that, for one, it wasn't exactly a strong ally that to help her in relation to the careers, but also that only one of them could win. I think people that criticize saying that Suzanne Collins wrote Katniss in a way that she doesn't have to make hard decisions are underestimating the Suzanne Collins wrote in there that Katniss does make. And just because Katniss never makes the conscious decision to pull her, you know, draw her arrow back and watch somebody and lead the target and fire the arrow, other than just instinctive with her first kill, or underestimating how tough some of the other decisions would be to make. Jord, does Suzanne Collins give Katniss an out?
Again, I think part of it depends on how you look at it. I think the of tough decisions is we all have different opinions on what the better thing would be. And so from each person's perspective, the decision she makes may seem like an easy decision because to us it seems like a no-brainer, or it may seem hard because we feel like she's going against what she may truly want to do. So for example, you talk about she volunteered for her sister. On the surface, yeah, it seems like she said that's the hardest thing you can do. However, you get the sense with Katniss, especially with her dad being gone, that her one purpose is to protect family. So if she doesn't volunteer for her sister, she's not protecting her sister, and it would go against her personality. Therefore, you could argue that a hard decision to make. When you talk about Rue, again, it comes down to perspective, because as you say, it may have been a decision for her to keep Rue as an ally. At the same time, she has an ally that she's able to use, and then she never has to come to the moment where it's either her or Rue. She gets bailed out by Rue being killed by someone else, and obviously she uses that opportunity, makes it a big and again, another one a lot of people talk about is at the very end, when they say that there can only be one winner, despite the early change that winners or two people from the same district could be co-winners. This was one of the biggest kind of tone changes in the movie. Perhaps it's just the way I viewed it, but I kind of got the sense that Katniss honestly didn't care if she lived or died, that she had kind of gotten this far and she was done playing the Capitals games. And so if they both died, despite, you know, obviously no, but despite that, it would be the ultimate kind of middle finger, so to speak, to the Capitol. Reading the book and reading that scene, I kind of got the more of the sense, you know, in the way, you know, she expects PETA to trust her, and that she knew that the Capitol wouldn't call her bluff. So reading and analyzing the book, I don't know if I can really say that's a hard decision she makes about to take her life, because I don't believe she was really going to make that decision. So from an analysis standpoint, I think there are definitely plenty of places you can do that show that maybe Suzanne Collins did give Katniss an easy out. And part of it, literary perspective, it just depends on where you want to take the book and where you want to take the plot. So you talked about Katniss joining. Yes, that's can be a hard decision either way. You can make the case that it's a hard decision to make that choice. And if you win your district, knowing that you let PETA die and dealing with that judgment. However, Suzanne Collins knew she wasn't going to take the book down, so it makes sense for Katniss to make that choice. So as far as a critique, I don't really criticize Collins for writing it that way, but it's kind of, a lot of people may say it's lazy writing or is an easy out, or you don't have to develop the character and make her make these hard decisions. I think it's more used to take the plot where she wants to go. Obviously, Katniss has to volunteer because she's the protagonist. That's where the story goes. Katniss, because after the games, there's the storyline between her and PETA. That's where she wants the story to go. Starting the rebellion, Katniss makes multiple acts against the Capitol, one of which is the decision to make it appear as if she's going to take the berries and kill herself. So I don't think I can really criticize Collins for the way she wrote it, but at the same time, I can't really make an argument against the claim that Katniss doesn't have to make a lot of hard decisions. Brandon, Nate and I kind of disagree on this one. Where do you fall on it?
So I fall about in the middle of you guys, I think. I think a lot of these easy decisions that she had, quote unquote, easy decisions that she had in there were to move the plot along. I mean, she just happened to have her sister, who had one name in the Reaping, be selected. Moves the plot along. She just happens to be put on the team that has... she just happens to be put on the team that has this great designer in Cinna that gets her a lot of attention. She just happens to be picked with the boy who has a crush on her. You know, a lot of that is you've got to remember who your audience is. And ultimately, this was pitched to and published by Scholastic. Scholastic is all about the young adults. It would have, I think it could have been a really neat story to have her be in the Capitol and have her designer want to put her in some stupid minor get up and then have her fight to get Cinna. That would be a great one, and that would have been a hard decision and hard things to do. But, you know, not too many young adult books can make it over the 500-page mark and be okay. If you look at her, if you look at the structure of the, and again, this is, we're talking about the first book, but I'm going to bring in things from the other two. The structure of the books, they're all in three parts. They all have the exact, all parts have the exact same amount of chapters. This is a very formulaically designed book for young adults and teens. And so I think that the easy decisions that she makes is because her audience isn't a literature class trying to develop characters who want to see this character develop. Her audience are young adults and teens who she wants to make think about how the social world works. And so the things that just happen and just work for her just happen and just work because that way she can talk about what she actually does want to talk about. She spends a lot of time talking about the social structure. She spends a lot of time talking about the seam and the middle class and the capital and how all of these, how you're stuck in all these systems once you get into them. So she writes away a lot of the problems that if this were a real world thing would have happened, but she wasn't writing it to be a great novel. She was writing it to have teens think about what the world is around them. I mean, she, one of the great things she did when she basically decided not to have them really kill people, like be cold-blooded killers, was when she and PETA, when Katniss and PETA were having that conversation, and PETA says that his biggest fear and the biggest thing he's going to try to do is to not let them change him. And Katniss agreed with it. And so they're not killers, and so they're not going to let the Capitol change them, but they will protect themselves. That's about all it boiled down to. And that way, Suzanne Collins didn't have to spend time on moral dilemmas of killing Rue, because that's not what the story was about. The story wasn't about the moral dilemma of killing. The story was about the unjustness of that social structure and about how the reality shows of today and how they're not really that much different from this story that she has. So I think that's, so yes, she does make it simple for some of the decisions, but it's to serve a purpose as a writer, I believe. I don't think she's doing it because she's a lazy writer. I think she's doing it so that she can spend more time on the themes that she does want to spend. Yes and no, I guess, is my answer. She writes it so that Katniss doesn't have to make a lot of the hard decisions, but she does it so that she can cover the themes that it's her goal to cover.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, I think you took it deeper and maybe a different perspective, but on a surface level, yeah, I agree. Like I said, I would agree with those who argue she writes it in that way, but like I said, I can't criticize her because she does it for a purpose for the she wants to take the story. But like you talked about, all of those different social aspects that she talks about, one literature perspective that a lot of people I've heard talk about, regardless of whether it's young adult, older people, literature class for leisure, it's the fact that, you know, obviously very different from the movie, the entire book is entirely in Katniss's perspective. So when you talk about all of those social aspects, issues that Suzanne Collins wanted to touch on, what she wanted to write about, what are some of the benefits and the hindrances of the book being entirely in Katniss's perspective? Because like you talked about, even from the very beginning, there is practically no social latitude. So from Katniss's perspective, you can see the evils of the Capitol. You can see this dystopian society. It hits on a lot of structures that are applicable to our day and time. But at the same time, because it's through Katniss's limited perspective, we may not get the full perspective. How is life like for people in the middle districts? Obviously, the Capitol and those higher districts are very... What sort of middle class is there? We don't see that because Katniss doesn't come into contact with that. it fits well into her narrative. But I think there are because we don't get that complete picture of this social structure, of the political structure, of everything surrounding this fictional world that's created. So Brandon, what would you say to that aspect?
So I think that the book, it does a good job at showing things from her perspective, like you were saying. You very clearly understand what Katniss is thinking and doing. But, you know, and the first time that I read this book, it actually was something that I thought of was, well, what's the other side of the story? And I'm not talking about the Capitol, because it's pretty clear that the Capitol is doing things that are not right. They're taking teenagers and putting them in a fight to the death. That's not right. I'm not going to defend that. But maybe Katniss's mother, because in that first couple chapters, Katniss's mother really seems like just this layabout mom who doesn't care about her kids at all. However, there were a couple little lines in there basically saying that she was going through depression and that she was taking the best medicines, which were herbs, that she had at her disposal, and basically that it's a disease. But from Katniss's viewpoint, she just gave up. She didn't care about her kids, and she just gave up. So I think that would have been interesting. It would have been interesting to see what life in District 12 was like for the middle class, because obviously PETA had a different experience growing up, and that they're even in the same district. It would have been interesting to see why exactly PETA burned the bread. Was it an accident, or did he do it because he wanted to take it out to Katniss? It would have been interesting to see things from the game master and the politicians, because here's something that the older I've gotten, the more I've realized. Every president goes out and promises to do something, and then they get voted in on whatever they promised. And then they go into whatever top secret meetings that they have, and half of what they promised, they just kind of forget about. They're like, oh, there was a reason this was being done this way, and I can't tell anybody why, but here's why. And so there's always another side to the story, which I wish that we had some of that. I wish that we would have, in this book, had more depth to why people did things. Because right now, from Katniss's perspective, it's all just, oh, well, PETA did this because he's a performer. Oh, PETA did this because he's lovestruck. Oh, Haymitch is drunk, and this is why he's doing this. Or, you know, it would have been nice to see actually why people were doing it and not just assume why. I think it would have added more depth to the characters. So, yeah, I think it was a hindrance to the book more than a benefit, because Katniss seemed to be the only character who had any thought and any emotion. But then again, you just have to kind of look at the audience and who she was writing it for. And she was not writing it for literary scholars. She was writing it for teens who she wanted to have take a look at this. Nate, what do you think? Were there benefits? Were there hindrances from this book being completely in Katniss's perspective?
I think whenever you write a book, no matter which way you're going to write it, you're going to have hindrances, have benefits. You know, you look at our last book that we did, Ender's Game, and the majority of that book is Ender and his perspective, but Orson Scott Card chose to show other ways to give us that story outside of what Ender knows. But I'm going to give a whole bunch of credit to Suzanne Collins for writing a book completely from Katniss's perspective, because how easy is it, their literary devices, to tell other parts of the story? And I think it would be even harder, and especially you look at the complete that Suzanne Collins was able to write from Katniss's perspective alone. She didn't use like Ender's Game, where the emails give you some things, or you look at George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire series, where each chapter is one person's perspective. But throughout the book, you get 15 to 17 different people who you get their perspective in a chapter to complete the story. So it's, you know, these some hindrances because we don't get the full picture. But I think the benefit in that is you get to know Katniss on a level you get to with a lot of other books. In the sense, if, you know, you look at, you know, if you were to write your own story, all you can write is from your perspective. You know, just like with Katniss, we don't know why PETA burned the bread, if it truly was an accident or if he did it on purpose. you know, if we're in that situation, if we're Katniss, we can look at it and speculate, but unless we have that actual conversation and ask PETA outright, we will never know. And I think that's one of the things that makes this book so successful is the fact that you get to know Katniss so well that, yeah, Katniss doesn't know all the details. Everything. There is this bigger world out there that she's just a small part of, but you get so connected to Katniss as a character and drawn in to this world and being a part of Katniss's world that I think it's a real benefit to it. You know, the biggest hindrance came when, you know, trying to adapt this to a movie because you can't stay completely true to the book. As how do you show when Katniss is stung by the Tracker Jackers and she's having her memories of what she learned in school about him and her hallucinations and things is what you get in the book. And the movie had to find another way to do that. And I think the movie did a very good way in doing that. But to me, that's the only hindrance I see is that when trying to take a book that is completely one from one perspective and adapt it to a movie, that there's changes and things that have to be made. But as far as the book itself, I think it was a huge benefit to what Suzanne Collins was trying to do. And a lot of credit to Suzanne Collins for being able to stick to writing this entire series perspective.
Yeah, I think definitely a lot of credit goes to her. That first-person perspective is hard to write an entire novel in. But with that said, focusing on the book, does it create a situation in which Katniss becomes a bit of an unreliable narrator, which may kind of make you question some of the aspects of the novel?
Yeah, I think that is a definite concern. It's more of a concern if you're going to sit there and analyze it. If you're going for a good story, she definitely gives a good story. But if you, like I said, if you're going to analyze it, she's completely unreliable. Not saying that she's wrong, just saying that you can't guarantee everything based off of just that one perspective. You know, you don't go to court with one witness, and if you're trying to find out the truth behind what actually happened, like I already mentioned, she makes her mom sound like she's just being lazy and just shuts off, where there's one line that makes me think that Suzanne Collins meant for her mom to have depression. Yeah, I think that gives her a completely unreliable narrative.
I don't know if you'd say necessarily unreliable narrative, but in the sense of, would you trust any teenager if they're giving you a narrative of how reliable narrative would be? So I think it gives you a true narrative of how a teenager sees the world.
Yeah, that's definitely a fair aspect. I know there's a lot to talk about with Hunger Games, but where we're sticking with the first book, there's only so much you can talk about Arena. And I think Katniss is such a fascinating character. So I really love the discussion with her. But one thing that I find interesting series is about Katniss. But if you're kind of taking a step back from Suzanne Collins from the writing perspective of it, so as if this was an actual occurrence, obviously, as we know, the series leads to the rebellion. So is Katniss simply the right person at the time the rebellion is bound to happen? Or are there traits in Katniss that make her the one that she was the catalyst? She was the only one that could spark.
So I think that is probably like so many questions from tonight, bits and pieces from both sides. Obviously, and I'm not going to foil too much, but you have people who were in place to do things to inspire this revolution. Things from Katniss's perspective, this goes back to the unreliable narrator. From Katniss's perspective, she just happened to fall into it. But from the themes of this book and from the overarching trilogy, it's a game. It's a setup. It's game masters on the other side, essentially, who are game makers who are saying that, okay, we need this to happen and this to happen and this to happen. And I bet you that every year that these people who are trying to get this rebellion started are looking at all of the tributes and saying, okay, who is going to fit our cause the best?
And when you have somebody who essentially defied the Capitol by volunteering as a tribute for her sister, that is, there's a symbol right there. That's propaganda like you can't buy. Also, in that chapter when Katniss goes up and volunteers, I think it's chapter 2, maybe chapter 3, the Capitol tries to get the people to treat this like a celebration, even though they're forced to be there at Reaping Day. And so if they were treating it like a celebration and Katniss volunteered, I think she would have been, it would have been a big cheering. But in the book, it said they didn't make a sound at all. That what they did was the three-finger salute that meant a lot of respect, and it was basically dead silent. So there was another... Okay, so you have a tribute who volunteered for her sister. You have a tribute whose entire district is basically standing in silent protest, which is pretty much all they can do without being thrown in jail. You have somebody who's obviously got a lot of fire. You've got a mentor who has a lot of personal demons that he's obviously dealing with, seeing so many people die and not feeling the justness of it. So, yes, things fell into place, but I have to... Everything outside of her district, I feel like, was put into place by the game makers on the other side. And so, I don't know. I would say that she was in the right place at the right time, but she was in the right place at the right time because of her traits. Traits led her to be there. If she hadn't been so protective of her sister, she wouldn't have gone. Prim obviously would not have been chosen to be the symbol for a rebellion. PETA had older siblings that did not volunteer for him. So familial bonds only go so far. So I think that it's quite a bit of both. Nate, what are your thoughts on it?
I think it's a lot more of Katniss having the traits that, as Jordan said, sparked the rebellion. I think that's a very apt term, because I think for 74 years in Pan Am, the Capitol has been sitting on a powder keg. You'd had a rebellion, you put the rebellion down in the districts, and as a consequence, you drew up the Hunger Games. But there's supposed to be a yearly thing to of basically why not to rebel. But in a sense, it's a yearly thing of reminder of how evil the Capitol can be, and there's a reason why we rebelled. And so I think the Capitol just has been sitting on this powder keg. Things had been put in place a long time before Katniss came around. It wasn't just Katniss being there that made things the right time, but it was Katniss volunteering for her sister and seeing that, and maybe this is the person we need. And so Cena being the one to put himself in position to be, a real person and to start doing some things, but they saw in Katniss the person who could be the match to light this powder. And so I don't think it was so much a coincidence of what Katniss was doing sparked the rebellion, as in more that this rebellion was ready to be sparked, and Katniss was the match that they finally found to light it. And, in this one, you see that yes, she kills people, but she's not a killer in the sense of like some of the careers were. And you see her and volunteering for her sister and what she does for Rue, which I think shows another example of just how much of a powder keg that the Capitol was sitting on, was that one jester by gesture. Yeah. Not a just juggler in the court, but a gesture that she makes towards Rue leads to rioting in 11, because they were on such tension and everything because of all this before, that seeing that act is what tipped things. And it was that trait in Katniss that lit that match in District 11. It was those traits in Katniss that Cena saw, that Haymitch saw, who's setting up the rebellion in District 13 saw, and saw that she could be this person, she could be the face. And she didn't have to necessarily be the tactical leader or anything like that for this rebellion, but she could be that person that, because of her humanity, that they could prop her up to be the face to inspire other people. So you know, Jord, we're split on this one to be the tiebreaker.
You're both split, but you're both oddly very close in your answers.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're split, but we're arguing the same side of the different coins, I think.
The general consensus that both have, I like the way you put it with the powder keg, Nate, and, you know, Brandon talking about the game makers putting stuff in place, being ready, and just kind of needing that match to light it all. I think that is probably the best analysis. In terms of how Katniss fits into that, I don't know if there's necessarily anything specific to Katniss that makes the rebellion, well, let me rephrase it, definitely certain aspects of Katniss that make her successful in the games and make her a good symbol for the rebellion. However, I don't think there's anything specific that made her any sort of quote-unquote the chosen one to lead the rebellion. I think there are definitely ways you can spark riots, you can incite, you know, rebellion. Like you said, it's on a powder keg. It doesn't take much to start certain things around her. I mean, Cinna is someone who, you know, her whole team around her, actually, it is full of people that are waiting to just of spark this, or waiting to stick it to the Capitol, are wanting to do these things that lead to the rebellion. Katniss and even people from 11 and 12 certainly aren't alone. I think, you know, in maybe an alternate universe, had Rue come out victorious with her innocence, could have been what the Capitol is doing and spark this rebellion to prevent other people like Rue, to prevent this innocence from their society being tainted. Because yes, she didn't die, but now she is forever tainted in a sense by having to go through that traumatic experience. Even if it's not directly being responsible for the death of people, it definitely would have been a great storyline to spark a rebellion. If you look at Gale, he's someone who definitely, I would say, understands the wrongs of the Capitol. He's not exactly like Katniss, but they're very different skill sets. But I think as someone who would have understand the magnitude of his actions if he were in the same situation as Katniss. With that said, it's nothing specific to Katniss. I think she was just one of a few kind of sets of people that had certain personality traits that could fit one of the multiple ways to carry out this rebellion. So like I said, people that I think the rebellion still would have happened, but the traits that Katniss does have definitely help her to be successful. You know, especially when you add in the aspect of her and PETA, maybe accelerates that timeline of the rebellion. I think we're all fairly, for the most part, agree on that one, just kind of slightly see it different ways. I know we've done quite a bit of analysis of the book, but of course most people are fans of this because of the movie, so let's talk about the big screen. How Hunger Games transferred to the big screen, what worked, what didn't work. Nate, you've already talked a little bit about this, so we'll start with you.
Yeah, it's, I think it translated well, but I think it's, you know, and it's just something I hate when you see, you try to take a book and put it into a movie and there's just never enough time. And, you know, I'm pretty sure I'm on record on here saying it because I've said it a lot of other times, but this is one I could have done better, split into two movies. That they always seem to wait until they get to the last book in the series to split it into two movies just to, you know, try to milk a movie. But what didn't translate well is they were so anxious in the movie to get to the, which is where a lot of the story takes place, a lot of the poignant parts of the story take place. But in that rush to get there, they didn't set up this world as well as you get set up in the book, in that first part of the book, in what it's like for them in District 12 and what Pan Am overall has been like since the rebellion, and, you know, what Katniss's home situation is like, and then even in the Capitol and stuff, like in their training, you know, you get kind of more of a montage thing instead of really like more of the details of what it was, you know, for them to be preparing and getting ready to go into this. And so I don't think did well is necessarily what this civilization, what this area in Pan Am, you know, whatever you want to call it, how drastic, how dire those situations were. But what did work well, like I was talking about before, is you're taking a book that is from one, and the way they adapted that to show the rest of the story, the other parts of the story, without being centrific on Katniss. You know, like I was talking about the Tracker Jacker part, where you see you're having the hallucinations at your game host, and she's hallucinating about him, and, you know, and he's standing there and talking about the effects of travel, and, you know, and it's, no, that's not how it was in the book, but you couldn't do how it was in the book, and so those changes they made were very well adapted to show that story. And I think overall, I think you still get the same impact of Katniss, like, to volunteer for her sister. I think you still get that impact in the movie. What it meant for her when Rue died, you still get that impact. The end of it when, you know, her and Peeta have survived, but Haymitch tells her, you know, hey, you got to keep playing this. Just because the game's over doesn't mean you're safe. Still gets that impact of it, right? So, doesn't get the complete story and the complete impact of it, but of the poignant emotional parts, I think translated and worked well. You know, George, you went from movie to book, so how does it work? You know, you're coming at it from a different perspective than the two of us.
I actually like to watch movies before I read the book, because I feel like when you read the book, it'll set up your certain expectations and what you want to see and what you think will translate well. And I think that's the number one reason why people say the book is never, or the book is a movie. You have to remember it's an adaptation, and what adapts best isn't necessarily what you want to see. So for my I think it's probably top five, maybe even top three of book to movie adaptations of all time. With what you were saying, Nate, about the two and showing that detail, personally, I don't think a lot of that detail really matters for the movie. Yeah, it's great for a book when you're establishing this and you're filling pages. But like you said, the emotional, the poignant parts, the parts that actually matter, translated well. I can tell you right now, if the first book was just from the beginning to before they entered the arena, or the first movie would covered those parts of the book, I probably wouldn't have seen the second movie, because I geared, there is very little conflict. There's very little, as far as the plot goes, I probably would have felt like I watched the first half of a movie. And so it is those poignant parts that have to be right and captures the emotion and the spirit. And so that's why I think it translated so well. Even with missing a lot of those details, like you talked about, when I was reading the book, there was very, very few details, very few scenes, very few added parts that really gave me any different sort of perspective. Like you said, there's obviously certain things. The Tracker Jacks are a good example, because obviously Katniss's memory and hallucinations are something that's hard to translate to the screen. But as far as their training, everything leading up to the games, most of everything going through the games, like I mentioned, the berries was probably the one thing. In the movie, I got the sense that she was ready to die, whereas in the book, I got the sense that she knew they wouldn't call her bluff. But I don't think adding those details into the movie really would have made much of a difference. One kind of exception is the end. When you look at kind of the interviews with the victors after the Hunger Games and how they transitioned that to set up for, but again, in all honesty, reading that end part, I really didn't feel like there's anything new I learned about Katniss or Peeta from the movie. And in all honesty, with how the movie was going, I don't know how well those interviews would have really fit I think how the movie ended was very fitting. And you had a resolution to the plot from the first movie, but you also knew that there were a lot of unanswered questions. There is a big next step that was about to take place as the series goes on. And really, I don't think you miss from the book in the movie. Like, yeah, certain things are changed, but on an emotional level, on the level of understanding the plot, I think it was absolutely perfect. And there's really not anything off the top of my head that I can think of that I would change. So Brandon, where do you fall on this one?
I fall into the thought that it was an excellent adaptation. One of my favorite ways that they adapted was to, and you guys have talked about the Tracker Jackers and stuff like that, but the one that stuck out to me was in the book, when Katniss is running from the fire and she gets burnt, she says to herself, I'm sure the game makers are in there laughing about the girl on fire. Well, you can't have that inner monologue in the movie. And so what they do is they actually show you the game room where they're controlling everything, and they make a joke about her being the girl on fire. So I think they kept the core of everything that was there. The only complaint that I have, and this might go back to exactly what you were saying, is I'm going in there with some expectations. I feel like the book definitely made me feel like Prim and that Katniss were on the very edge of starvation. I think the book made me feel like they were very destitute. And I'd never felt that way in the movie. And part of it is because, you know, Jennifer Lawrence doesn't look like, you can't count her ribs. I mean, she's not wasting away. She's not overweight or anything, but she's definitely not wasting away like the book makes Katniss and Prim sound to be. Now, casting wise, I really liked the casting on that. I thought that was great. The whole thing with Gale, I feel like they kind of neutered the Gale and PETA thing a little bit, because Gale is not necessarily as large of a character in the movie as he is in the book. So Katniss's inner turmoil over that doesn't come through as well. But the parts of the plot, and this goes back to what we were saying, what's your audience and what points are you trying to get across? I feel like those came across really well. What Suzanne Collins seems to have been striving for with the book came out in the movie. And you know what? To be honest, one fewer love triangle that that anyone really cares about is a better thing in my book. The core things transferred, little details on the edge, I feel like they didn't. And like you said, it's a book into a movie, and they do what they have to do, because books are longer media than movies. There's just no way around it. That's part of the reason why I like audiobooks even more than watching a movie on TV, because you get more entertainment out of the same story. So, all right, Jordan, what do you think? Did we cover that one fairly well?
Yeah, I think we covered it pretty great. I guess if Nate wants to respond, movies are always a hot topic for him when they're adapted from books.
No, that's just my feelings on it. Like I said, I think as an adaptation, it turned out good. I just, you know, like I said, I always want more, because trying to cram a full novel into a 2-hour movie, there's never enough.
Yeah, that's fair. And that's why, like I said, like you even said, the emotional and poignant parts are what matters. And I think that Hunger Games really cast all of those important parts.
All right. Well, then I think we are wrapped up for this Hunger Games Book 1 book club, end of Book 1, as they did it in the book. Just a big old splat. All right. So thanks for listening to the Fandom Podcast. Be sure to head over to our website, fandompodcast.com, and subscribe, or use whatever podcatcher you use. We're in all the directories, Stitcher, iTunes, you name it. We're going to have on Facebook, Twitter, and our website chances for you to answer the question, what is fandom to you? Answer that question, head over to fandompodcast.com/funcomfortable, and you will have a chance to win a pair of tickets to Chris Hardwick's performance on November 6th at Kingsbury Hall. If you want to reach out to us, Jordan is on Twitter @EasyHandle. Nate is on Twitter @NathanFandom, or on Facebook, facebook.com/NathanFandom. And I am on Twitter @OvergrownAsian.